This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW, because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour, the boots that turn grocery aisles into runways, and all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between, because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
This President's Day, upgrade the look of your home without breaking your budget. Save up to 50% site-wide on brand new window treatments now at Blinds.com. Blinds.com, the number one online retailer of custom window treatments, is the better way to give your home the presidential treatment. Blinds.com makes it easy with free virtual consultations on your schedule and samples delivered directly to your door, fast and free. Choose from trending woven wood shades or upgrade to motorized. Blinds.com has everything and more, all with upfront pricing and no hidden fees. Need help with installation? Blinds.com can handle it for you. Or DIY with expert guidance from our design pros. With over 25 million windows covered and our 100% satisfaction guarantee, you can count on Blinds.com to deliver results you'll love. Shop Blinds.com's President's Day Mega Sale right now and save up to 50% site-wide, plus a free professional measure. Up to 50% off site-wide at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
I thought I'd go with roll with the changes this morning to ring the opening bell because, you know, sometimes you eat the bar, sometimes the bar eats you. Bar ate us yesterday. Hopefully you won't eat us today. And I'll tell you this, I'm not trying to be negative, but if I hear one more alleged news story about Starbucks, I think I'm going to lose it. Look, if you want to spend $38 on a cup of coffee, go ahead, but caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. Maybe you're going to be overcharged. Maybe you're going to wait in line. Maybe you're not. I don't know. But if Starbucks has news to get out, call a sales department. Now that I've got that off my chest, let's come back and talk to Alex Durante, senior economist at the Tax Foundation, about tariffs, the effects of them once they're instituted, and who pays, who doesn't. Then we're going to talk to Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, about bird flu and the price of eggs and groceries and more. Got a big show. Stay tuned. Back in a flash, WWL. 6:16 now. I believe whatever rain we had is gone. And that means it's going to be a little bit cooler today than it has been. Highs today of only 66 and cloudy. Highs of 65 tomorrow. More rain on Saturday. Temperatures near 80. Sunday, really rainy, highs near 70, and then a cold front comes through Monday, highs of only 57, plenty of sunshine. Alex Durante joins us now, senior economist at the Tax Foundation. Good morning, Alex. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk tariffs, can we?
Yes, sounds good.
I don't know where we are on this. This is kind of like a game, a tariff hold'em, it seems like. I'll see you're 5. Well, I'll raise you 10. I'm in for 20. All right, let me fold on this one. Tell me where is that kind of what's going on here or not?
No, I think that's basically what's going on. It definitely seems like we're in the midst of an escalating trade war. You know, we saw some of this about a week ago where Trump, you know, announced new tariffs on Canada and Mexico. Right now, those are going to be paused for a month as they work on some negotiations. But it does seem likely those will go into effect. And then this week, we also received new announcements of tariffs on steel and aluminum imports. So there's going to be higher tariffs on those, and also more of them on different product lines. And, you know, we immediately saw with Canada and Mexico that they had intended to retaliate against us. And China has already announced more retaliatory tariffs on our goods after we announced we were going to be tariffing more of theirs. So right now it definitely seems like we're in the midst of some kind of escalation.
One thing I like is the use of tariff as an active verb, tariffing. I like that. Let's talk about at what point do we as consumers, does it affect us? Because now it's a lot of political posturing, it's a lot of saber rattling, whatever cliche you want to use. You tariff us, we'll tariff you, but maybe it's a negotiating ploy by President Trump. At what point and how does it manifest itself into our money? Because that's what we're all concerned about, right? Or maybe even manufacturing or jobs in a country?
Yep, that's right. Yep. The short answer is it's very complicated because we know from the economic evidence of certainly since 2018 that it is the importer that is paying almost all the tariff, not say the country that's being tariffed like China. Now, whether or not they decide to pass all of that cost increase onto the consumers really depends on the type of good that's being tariffed. If it's a final good, generally, that's going to be passed fully on the consumer. If it's an intermediate good, they might have some flexibility and other margins to adjust. So they might, instead of passing it fully on the consumer, they might reduce investment, hire fewer workers, for instance. So even if the cost isn't fully passed on the consumer, just like you said, there's still negative effects across a street of industries because firms' input costs are going to be rising under these tariff regimes, and they're going to have to find some way to absorb that cost.
So when it comes to this game of tariff hold'em that I started this conversation with, because that's what it seems like what's going on, has anybody won a pot yet?
Well, you know, trade wars, contrary to what President Trump has said, are not good and easy to win. You know, we have a lot of evidence, going back all the way to the Great Depression on how tariff or how trade wars play out, and the results have generally not been very good. Contrary to I think what a lot of their proponents expect, they tend not to deliver economic benefits to the country that imposes them. And in fact, what we've seen since 2018 is actually a reduction in economic growth because of the tariffs.
It seems to me, and we'll pick it up here when we come back, we're talking to Alex Durante, senior economist at the Tax Foundation. When it comes to a trade or tariff war, trade war, whatever you want to call it, it seems like the Russians in Afghanistan that... Nobody's going to win this. It's just going to be a bloodbath for everybody, and I don't know what we're really going to accomplish. But if you all have any questions about tariffs, I'd like to hear from you. Somebody texted in. You can address this when we come back, Alex. Less Chinese goods and less money for the Chinese military. Well, maybe so, maybe not. I think a bigger concern is, and for example, if you're going to worry about China, is the amount of cranes that they have operating ports and what kind of intelligence could be built into those cranes, and could China shut down our port with a simple click of a mouse? That, to me, would be the bigger concern. But we'll drill down when we come back. Text your questions in. The Oquinard Jeweler Talk and Text Line, 504-260-1870. Traffic now. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Alex Durante, senior economist at the Tax Foundation, trying to make sense of tariffs. And somebody texted in, less Chinese goods and less money for the Chinese military. Somebody else texted in and said, the person who texted about China was literally texting on a Chinese-made device, which they own for an affordable price because it's made in, wait for it, China. Alex, thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, look, there are reasons for sure, to be concerned about China and its emergence as a superpower, and it is true. I mean, they definitely do engage in some unfair practices, such as intellectual property theft. But I think we have to really ask ourselves if tariffs are really the best ways to address this issue. You know, going back to, let's say about 7-8 years ago, you know, one of the things that U.S. negotiators were working on was negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which would have been a free trade agreement with those other countries in the Southeast Asian region.
When does that go back to, Alex? That goes back to when?
Going back to really during the Obama administration, the beginning of the Trump administration. You know, we had these negotiations, and President Trump, you know, announced that he was going to pull out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think if he had done that, that would have done a lot of good, because it would have enabled us to put economic pressure on China and help develop better trading relations with other countries in that region. But unfortunately, what we've seen from the fallout of that is that China went ahead and forged their own agreement with those countries. So now the U.S. Has even less of a seat at the table. But I think if we had, moved somewhere in that direction, and also, you know, we have, you know, the World Trade Organization, you know, we can continue to bring disputes to them. Usually in their tribunals, the U.S. tends to prevail. I don't really think that, you know, it's the case that we've exhausted all of our other avenues and that we have to, resort to tariffs. I think there's still other things the U.S. can do to counter China. But I think if you look at the past 7 years since the tariffs have gone to place, we haven't really achieved any of these objectives that we set out to. And at the same time, we've also hurt American workers and manufacturers and the manufacturing industry with the tariffs.
And the argument is, it's a circuitous one, but that if you put tariffs on imports, then the stuff will be made here. But American consumers already have a choice of buying things that are made here if they want to pay more for it, but they don't do it. They buy the cheaper Chinese goods. Is that accurate or not?
Yes, that's exactly right. And also, I think it's important to keep in mind that, I mean, if some of that production is onshored, you know, that means that the prices of those goods will be higher. And if consumers are spending more money on those higher priced domestic goods, that means that they actually have less money to spend elsewhere in the economy. So on net, you know, contrary to what's been claimed, the economy actually ends up worse off, because while, say, maybe one industry benefits, there's a lot of other industries that are just losing out because consumers just wouldn't have as much money to spend under that scenario. So I think that's why.
Finish. No, finish, please.
I think that's why, you know, the idea that, oh, we could just, the companies, they could just onshore production and then they get around the tariffs and then, you know, but our workers win. I think that's why that's just not a very good analysis based on the academic evidence that we have of tariffs.
I think it's a good idea, but I don't think it holds true. Thank you, Sir Alex Zirani, Senior Economist at the Tax Foundation. Mike Strain, when we come back, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, bird flu making itself known around the country, price of eggs, etc. We'll talk about it with him when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. Nice, clear Thursday, well, cool Thursday morning, not clear. Crescent City Connection lit up against a background of gray clouds, purple, gold, and green, getting us ready for Mardi Gras. Cruise ship docked in air, light shining, city shimmering, just as it has throughout the Super Bowl coverage. Man, more excitement coming up. We got a big concert announcement coming up at 9:30 from the Dome. We'll have that for you. Then the Saints press conference introducing Kellen Moore at 11:30. And as if that's not enough, Mike Strain when we come back on WWL. 6:44, 16 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. It's time to talk to Mike Strain, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, as we always do. How you doing, Mike?
Man, I am doing great. You know, we're getting ready to start planting. It won't be long. We start getting our, you know, corn in the ground. And of course, then soon thereafter, a lot of areas, soybeans. Looks like our sugar crop is doing, you know, very well. We're really excited. We've got some strawberries, you know, coming along. And look, crawfish, you can find them now raw. They're in New Orleans at $3.75 a pound for some real nice ones. You know, you can also find some boiled ones, like at Rouse's, for $4.49 to $5. So, look, it's crawfish time. It's carnival time. And we're very excited. We're very happy. Now is the time.
Well, one good thing, if somebody has a political protest, chances are they're not going to be throwing eggs because they're too damn expensive. Tell me what's going on, Mike, with eggs and bird flu and availability and prices and all that stuff.
Yeah, if you look at last week, for the wholesale markets, average wholesale price medium-sized eggs in this part of the United States, wholesale price was $7 a dozen. Mm. Overall availability of from the warehouses going to the markets was about 65%, which means all the stores that ordered eggs got about 65% of their order. With bird flu, we have lost about 10% now of our total egg production over the last 4 months. We're still having ongoing bird flu issues. The bottom line is that we're going to have to vaccinate these birds. We've got to stop this in its tracks. We've lost a significant portion of our egg-laying hens. And so you just don't, in a week say, look, we're going to increase production. We're producing all the eggs that we can with the hens that we have. And so we've got to have the hens that lay the eggs that become the hens that lay the table eggs. So it's a process. So that and other inflationary pressures, different methodologies that hens have to be raised in to meet California standards, which about 40% of the hens in the United States are raised under the standards set by the state of California because of what's called Proposition 12. Mm-hmm. That's a whole other story, which means they are basically, quote, cage-free, which increases cost, and then overall inflationary costs. So all that comes together, plus just the lack of availability, has driven price. Now, that being said, what's going to happen? Well, one, people are eating less eggs because of the cost. That will increase some availability and will maybe stabilize the price. However, according to the USDA, we fully expect eggs to go up an additional 20 to 25% this year until we can get supply back up to meet demand.
Does cage-free lend itself to the more rapid spread of bird flu, Mike?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Because with the bird flu, the predominant way that bird flu gets into the poultry houses is by contact with wild birds. So if a duck or a goose, a sick duck or goose, lands into that, quote, cage-free area, then it can pass that infection along. And so because they're out there on the grass or out on the ground and not within a contained building that has an air filtration system, it is more likely to cause, to result in that infection. It can still happen in the hen houses that are totally enclosed and under air filtration cooling systems. It can still happen because the virus is so hot, just the mere presence of a wild, sick goose on the property can have the possibility of transmitting it into those chicken houses. And also, it can be transmitted by the workers themselves. So extreme biosecurity. And we can keep watching this, this bird flu, because now, we're calling it, one of the names is metapneumovirus because it's jumping from species to species. A new type was seen in Nevada, just last week. And then that particular type infected a human being that worked on the poultry farm. So, the bird flu that's in our dairy animals and the bird flu, dairy flu, that the high path avian influenza bovine type is also trying to jump into people. The good news is that it has not moved person to person, but we have to be very vigilant and we need to, move along. And there are companies that are trying to develop vaccines for our poultry, for our beef, for our cattle. And we may need to have some on side, as we, change and go into next flu season to where we can have better protection against avian type as well as, quote, the human-type flu.
Better protection for the animals or for humans?
Everybody.
Okay.
Everybody. The whole ultimate goal of public health is to make sure this disease doesn't get into the human population. Everything we're doing is to focus on, one, yes, for the animals' health, keeping the animals alive, keeping them in production, but keeping this virus out of the human population. We talk about the disease pyramid. Humans are right at the top. They're at the capstone of this pyramid. And everything in the environment, plants and animals and insects and wildlife, any diseases are down at the base of that pyramid. And the goal is that it never makes it to the top. And that's something we're working very hard on, have to be vigilant on. But there's a lot of virus out there. high path avian influenza in wildlife is everywhere, and it's predominantly in wild ducks, wild geese, and then it can spill over into our commercial flocks, you know, not only for our you know, chickens, you know, and the egg-laying hens, but also in our, you know, commercial poultry production, you know, for chicken, but also into our dairy herds. The reason it gets in the dairy herds, it is transmitted predominantly in the milk. The virus likes setting up in the mammary glands and can actually shed in the milk for weeks before the animals become sick. And so that's one of the ways that it got out of control. It started off with 3 herds in the Texas Panhandle and is now in more than 900-plus herds in 19 states.
Mike, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. You're a scientist. You're a well-respected veterinarian. I know you spent a lot of time in the lab. You've forgotten more about this than I could ever understand, but 10% of the egg production lost in the last 4 months seems pretty substantial to me. And somebody texted in, I don't know if they're trying to be funny or not, but said vaccines and stay-at-home orders for the chickens. Ha ha. I know that there's a lot of political blowback after COVID and so forth, but that being said, this is substantial to me when you talk about 10% of egg production in the last 4 months, then spreading the population, jumping species. I'm talking about food supply here and the prices that we're going to pay. This seems pretty important to me. We'll talk more when we come back with Mike Strang, Commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, 651, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 6:56, 4 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Mike Strang, Commissioner, Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Mike, you are an elected official. You are a scientist. 10% of the egg production in the last 4 months seems significant to me. And then you're talking about dairy cattle and everything else. How concerned are you that politics gets in the way of science here? Because the two never get along, do they really?
Well, that's part of the discussion. You know, generally speaking, when it comes down, when you have to make those hard health decisions, The politics backs up, you know, in favor of proper health. And if you look in the veterinary world, we vaccinate our cattle. Mm-hmm. We vaccinate our dogs. We vaccinate our cats. We vaccinate our horses. And under very limited circumstances do we vaccinate our poultry. We vaccinate our swine. That's why it's called herd health. And so there are a number of companies, for instance, Moderna, has been awarded $590 million to develop a vaccine against bird flu. Mm-hmm. And so there are many companies that are developing, working on vaccines.
Mike, let me jump in for one.
Dominate the animal world.
Yeah, let me jump in for 1 second. Do we have a vaccine against this bird flu, or they're working on it?
We are very close.
Okay.
I think we have some types that could be used. We could develop them quickly, and I think we need to go ahead and push it across the finish line. The issue with vaccinating our poultry is that our foreign trading partners say they will not buy poultry from the United States, poultry or eggs, if we vaccinate our chickens against bird flu. Well, the bottom line is if we don't start vaccinating our chickens, we may not have any poultry to sell them. So it's time that we need to go ahead, vaccinate our chickens like we vaccinate everything else and put this disease to rest. We need to stop this disease. One, to protect our food supply, but two, to make sure it does not spill over into the human population.
So if we don't,
we also need to develop a way to vaccinate wildlife.
If we don't, where are we 4 months from now?
Where are we 4 months from now?
If we lose another
10 to 20% of our poultry production. You know, if you remember a number of years ago, we lost hundreds of millions of birds, which caused the price of chicken to go astronomical. If you remember that, you got up to $10 per chicken, and poultry is a very necessary protein. So if we don't, things will get significantly worse before they get better. But the bottom line is that this virus is continuing to modify itself. We saw the new cases in Nevada, and the virus wants to jump into the human population. So we've got to eliminate the virus in the environment, protect our food supply, and keep it from ever getting into the human population.
Everybody loves Mike Strang. You got, we got some powerful people on Washington, in Washington on Capitol Hill with Mike Johnson and Steve Scalise. I know you've been talking to them. Are they listening to you, Mike, and on top of this bird flu situation?
I think so. You know, I think, you know, there's an anti-bias against vaccination of humans. And that's an individual choice. But vaccinating our livestock is something we've always done. And if we don't do it, you know, basically, you know, we will lose our food supply. And that's something that I'm very sure and comfortable that we're going to be able to do, and that, you know, politics is not going to get in the way of that. Because, again, if you choose or not to choose to get your flu shot this year, that has components to protect you from high path avian influenza.
That's your choice.
Because the virus is trying again to modify itself.
Thank you, Mike. We're going to miss the golden voice of Tom Fitzmaurice going to the Aqua phone and the Blue phone and the Magenta phone and all of that. In case you haven't heard, Tom Fitzmaurice passed away at the age of 74. He'd been ill. This is his music that I'm playing here because he loved that kind of stuff when he would do his show. He was around for over 50 years covering restaurants. He had a lot to do with the Katrina recovery because he promoted the restaurants coming back after Katrina, and had the restaurants not come back, I don't know if the city would have come back. So I think he's one of those untold stories of Katrina. He also, I think, coined the phrase the Katrina hug. And that's where you would see somebody years after Katrina that you hadn't seen, and you just spontaneously hug them. He was a very, very talented man, a very, very smart man, very creative man, very funny man. And he, it was hard to see later in his life the effects of Alzheimer's. That's what eventually complications from that caused his death. And people are texting in about the supposed feud that he and I had, and he concocted this just to get people to talk about it. He and I were very, very good friends, and Tom Fitzmaurice was just one of the more talented people ever, I think, to be on the airwaves in New Orleans, and he's one of these iconic New Orleans personalities, and I hope we all remember him well. He's got books that you can find all over the place, and our thoughts and prayers go out to his family and his children. And he was a proud Jesuit Rummel alum, because I think he went to one and graduated from the other, but either way, man, he was a friend. He was a New Orleans icon, and we're going to miss him a lot. We really are, and we have missed him in the time that he's been ill. So God bless you, Tom Fitzmaurice. Enjoying a big old fancy meal up in heaven wherever you are. We'll take a break, come back, talk to Jason Adriance about flounders and alligators and more here on WWL. 7:15, getting some texts about Tom Fitzmaurice, quoting him, it doesn't matter how fancy the party is, how expensive the food is, if there are finger sandwiches, they will always be the first thing I go to. And I asked Tom one time how he could eat all of these meals and not be heavy, because he reviewed so many restaurants, and he told me that his secret was, as soon as the entree came, if he was by himself, he would separate it in half, because he would have leftovers constantly, right? And I guess, in a way, now you can look at it as a waste of food. But he would take the salt shaker and immediately cover the second half of it with salt so it was inedible, so he couldn't eat it no matter how good it was. And that's how he managed to keep his weight down. But he was a tremendous man, a smart guy, new vocabulary guy. He knew, for example, that the word flounder and founder could be used interchangeably. And sometimes people correct each other, saying, no, if you mean sink, you're saying flounder and you mean founder, or the other way around. But according to Webster's, both can be used interchangeably. Not, however, when it comes to the fish. When it comes to the fish, then you got to use flounder. And with that in mind, Jason Adriance joins us now, fisheries biologist of the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. How you doing, Jason?
Good morning. Doing well. Yourself?
I'm well, sir. Everybody has a story, and I always like to hear everybody's. How do you become a fisheries biologist with the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries?
It's a little bit of a long story. I actually grew up in the Midwest, but had a biology teacher that would constantly show us Jacques Cousteau films. And so I had these visions of scuba diving for a living, and that didn't work out. But here I am.
Everybody's got a story, Jason, and that's why I wanted to hear yours. Tell me the story of flounder in Louisiana.
Sure. As you may know, we've had some issues with the flounder stock over the last decade. The population has gone down to a point where we needed to enact some management restrictions further than we already have. And so in 2022, our Wildlife and Fisheries Commission established a fall and winter closure. So October 15th through all of November, commercial and recreational harvest of that species is restricted. And that was done because the population, the spawning portion of that population, is too low. We need to recover it to a more sustainable biomass. And the problem with flounder, even though we use the term overfished, that a better way to say that with flounder is that stock's depleted. It's not a result of our fishing activity. It's a result of the biomass. There's been lower recruitment, so we've had fewer younger fish make it into the estuary after spawning, after those adults spawn.
Well, hang on. Let me slow you down a little bit. Yeah, let me use the timeout here. Adrian's, Jason, if I can, I got three of them, and I want to use one of them right here before the clock runs out. And that is, you talk about recruitment. Is that what you said? And biomass? Take me through that a little bit, what that means, because it's easy to say it's overfished, but you're saying that's not the reason.
Well, yeah, it's so normally if you hear the term overfished, folks think it's too much fishing. It's a technical term we use when the spawning stock of a species is too low. The technical term is overfished. Mm-hmm. Now, when I talk about recruitment, that's after the adults offshore spawn and these larvae move inshore into the estuaries. Recruitment is those young juvenile fish that make it into the estuary and survive to enter the fishery. So our recruitment that we look at is those young fish that survive through that high mortality on those younger ages and make it into the fishery.
And what was hurting that?
Yeah, so flounder are a little unique. There's part of it is the biomass is too low, so not enough fish spawning. But another unique aspect of their biology is they have temperature-dependent sex determination. So when those young larvae are moving inshore, if water temperatures are around 64 degrees, it's pretty much a one-to-one male-to-female ratio. But if those estuarine water temperatures are much higher, you can skew that male-to-female ratio to almost 7-to-1, being 7 males to every female. So you end up having this disproportionate amount of males and not enough females.
So the change in the water temperature was temporary or not?
Well, it's just during the critical time of year. So those young flounder are coming into our estuaries between February and March, this time of year. Mm-hmm. And so this time of year is when those water temperatures are critical. And if we've had really warm springs and those water temperatures have been really warm, then that leads to more male flounder.
Throws the balance off. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We come back. We're talking to Jason Adrians, fisheries biologist of the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. I'm a golfer. I am not a fisherman. So if y'all have any questions, please text them in to 504-260-1870, because I don't know what I don't know. I will say this, Jason, you scared me, because when you said recruitment, I was expecting fish to start wanting name, image, and likeness money. 721 traffic now, WWL. 727, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Jason Adrians, fisheries biologist with the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries, about flounder populations. When it comes to hitting a flop shot over a bunker, I'm your guy, but when it comes to fishing, not so much, so I defer to the audience. Somebody texted in, Jason, and says, so after this winter, there ought to be an overabundance of female flounders. Is that accurate or not?
It's not quite accurate. If the water temperatures stay in that optimum range with this cooler spring, then it should be closer to a 1-to-1 sex ratio. That doesn't mean we'll have more juvenile flounder survive. There's some other things that go on as well. Obviously, our coast, everyone knows how much habitat we're losing. So that plays a role in terms of nursery areas for these young fish. And I want to add, this is not just a Louisiana issue. This is the issue with flounder has been Gulf-wide and even up the southeast coast. A lot of states have noticed this issue with flounder.
You're reading ahead, because the next text here, Jason, was, what about the loss of coastal habitat?
Yeah, that's a big thing moving forward as we lose more of that habitat that's conducive to fish, and we have less habitat to support our populations. Those issues will persist.
Somebody else wants to know about flounder bycatch because of shrimping, and I don't know quite how you catch a flounder. Do you bottom fish for that, or what's the deal on that, Jason?
Well, so there's the legislature. There's been a lot of flounder regulations throughout history, or at least in the last couple of decades, and one that's legislative here in Louisiana is that all flounder caught as trawl bycatch can be kept on a shrimping vessel. One thing that happened that allowed this closure that was put in place to happen was the legislature adjusted that if the stock is overfished or undergoing overfishing, the department could regulate that bycatch. And the peak times for flounder bycatch and shrimping activity is in that time period from mid-October through November, when that's when all the females move down the coast and move offshore to spawn. So that was our biggest bang for the buck in terms of protecting that stock and trying to rebuild it, is to try to let as many females as possible make it offshore to spawn.
Only 30 seconds left. Let me get to this one. Can you ask if there will be any restrictions on redfish or speckled trout due to the cold fish kill? And I got to follow up with, was there a cold fish kill?
We did have fish kills related to this recent freeze event. There's a document online with that's tied to a news release that you can link to that shows the effort we put forward in documenting those. We did observe both red drum and trout mortality in going out after the freeze. At this time, there's no pending restrictions based on that. We're just going to continue to monitor those stocks.
Jason, I'm glad you watched Jacques Cousteau, and I'm glad we got you from the Midwest. Jason Adriance, fisheries biologist with the Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fisheries. Jason, quickly, is there a website where fishermen can go or fisher ladies and get all the information they need?
Sure. It's our homepage, which is www.wlf.louisiana.gov.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. We'll come back, talk to Joe Geruso about this school board city settlement. Ridiculous foolishness. Right now, time for WWL First News. Here we go, 7:40, 20 till 8. Big day at WWL. You know, we got the Saints press conference for you at 11:30 when they introduce Kellen Moore, new head coach. Gail Benson's going to be there along with Mickey Loomis and more. And before that, at 9:30, Mike Haas is going to make a big announcement at the Superdome at the Caesars Superdome, about a concert involving two big stars in one big concert. Who do you think it's going to be? Beyonce and Jay-Z? Maybe Paul McCartney and Ringo? Seals and Crofts? I don't know, but we'll find out at 9:30 when Mike Haas announces it live here on WWL. When we come back, we'll talk to Joe Geruso about this foolishness involving the mayor's office and this Orleans Parish School Board settlement, skimming money. Where did it go? What are they doing with it? It's a mess. We'll be back. Tommy Tucker, WWL. 7:45, quarter till 8. Quickly to Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council member. Joe, you went to Jesuits. I'll quote Shakespeare: "All the world's a stage, all the men and women merely players." I try to cut them.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, like Aloe, Allbirds, or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling and for shoppers buying simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet and the not so secret secret with Shop Pay that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going. So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell whenever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout experience as business powerhouses like Aloe, Allbirds, and Skims. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, we share stories that are funny, strange, heartbreaking, and above all, true.
I myself have been married for 56 years. Unfortunately, to four different women.
It turns out the people I was looking for all my life is what you people would call nerds.
Follow and listen to The Moth on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Air some slack, because I know there's a private part and there's a public part. And when I saw her in front of the Super Bowl committees and everything else and the NFL taking a bow, it's like, okay, but really, that's the show business part of it. The nuts and bolts of running government, you're not so good at. I heard you and Newell talking about this, and we first started talking about it last week, the Orleans Parish School Board settlement. I'm going to just turn it over to you, because you can explain it more concisely than I can. What I cannot believe, looking at you and J.P. Morrell and Freddie King and Leslie Harris, that they would go before a board of lawyers and try to present this stuff, this foolishness. But take it over, Joe, if you would, please.
Yeah, so we made a deal with the administration based on a lawsuit that has been pending against the city by the school board regarding the city illegally withholding funds from the school board. And the short of it, Tommy, is there's obviously taxes that are collected by the city, including property taxes that the city collects on behalf of people, including the Orleans Parish School Board. And what the city has been doing is taking money off the top of those ad valorem taxes as an administrative fee. This has already been litigated in the downtown development district, and the city lost. So there's almost no doubt in this instance that the city's going to lose again. So knowing that, and knowing that there is a potential liability of over $100 million, doesn't it make sense to find an accord, a compromise, an agreement that works all of it out? And as JP said during the meeting, the linchpin of the deal is to stop withholding this money that the city is taking as a collection fee or as other fees. And to me, from a four-hour meeting, the most telling part of the meeting is when I asked the administration if the school board or the state or the sheriff or somebody else agreed to collect the taxes for the school board and not the city, would you be okay with the deal? And they wouldn't answer the question. So that shows me one thing, Tommy, that this is all about the money and that the city doesn't want to relinquish what it considers to be a revenue stream on the backs of children that should be going to kids and the city shouldn't have been collecting for years.
So people approved this millage for education. And then I heard you use the word, or Newell did yesterday, that really got my attention as a fan of mob movies, and that was skim. And basically that's what the city is doing, right? Skimming money off of the fund that people, or the millages that people voted for schools to use for whatever they want to use. Accurate?
I think I use the word skim.
You
and
did.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. Well, think about it sort of two ways. Number one, you just made the point. The millage is about money for kids. The millage language does not say the city shall collect a portion of this millage money as part of its obligations. So just the language of the ballot proposition itself does not allow the city to do that. That's number one. Then number two, as a practical matter, and I raised this on Newell yesterday too, the city's already collecting money for NOPD, for NOFD, for the parks, for other things. I mean, is it really an $8 to $11 million lift for the city to collect the school's money when it's already collecting for so many other entities, not only because they're already doing it, because theoretically all the efficiencies that it should be created in doing this, that just doesn't make any sense.
Joe, let me take a break, because I want to pick it up from here. We come back. I'm no Joe Geruso or Newell Norman. I didn't go to Jesuit. Maybe that's part of it. I don't know. But anyway, I am a Freddie King, though, because I went to Shaw. But here's the point. If they were supposed to have $100 million that goes to the schools, and they collected 20, and the settlement's for 16, is that accurate so far?
So the settlement is actually $100 million, but it's over 10 years. So it's $20 million to the school district this year. It stopped collecting the fee that they shouldn't be collecting. And then from this year and for the next 9 years afterwards, It's money for programs for kids, including workforce development and mental health and incarcerated kids, et cetera.
All right, let me simplify it. So when we come back, will the OPSB ever get what they were supposed to get from this millage? And what happened to the money that the city collected? Where did that go? Do you know? 751, more with Joe Geruso. We come back. Traffic now, WWL. 756, talking to Councilmember Joe Geruso about the city and skimming money from the millage for the Orleans Parish School Board. You can go to WWL.com and listen to Newell and Joe talk about this lawyer to lawyer. This is dumb West Bank guy to lawyer, the conversation we're having now, Joe. So the first question is, will the school board ever get all of the money that they were supposed to get?
Well, that's what the motion to enforce the settlement is going to settle next week in court. Obviously, we prefer it not get to that point, but the school board's going to litigate it, so it's coming to a head quicker rather than later.
So we don't know yet?
Don't know yet.
All right, so the money that the city did skim, where did that go and how much money are we talking about?
It's somewhere several million dollars per year. I think the estimates I've heard got up to between $8 and $10 million per year. My assumption, Tommy, is that it went into the city's general fund, which is obviously just the big pool of money the city has to pay all of its obligations, and it can go to anything. Is it possible some of the money went to kids? Yes. Is it also possible it went to changing lights and doing other things? Also, yes.
But can the city spend money that the city council doesn't allocate? And I don't want to get too far in the weeds on this, but that's what confused me.
Yeah, I mean, the city can't spend money on things it didn't allocate. And again,
that the council didn't allocate, right?
That the council didn't allocate. Correct. Well, that's part of what our frustration was yesterday at the end of the meeting, was that the administration has said they've now overspent on public safety over time by $50 million. Well, we didn't allocate any funds for that to happen. So how are you going ahead and spending this money or authorizing this money without having a much in-depth public conversation about it?
So when it comes to this foolishness of they weren't aware of it, just, I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but we do have a minute left, Joe. So just talk about that idiocy, if you would, please.
Yeah, look, that's why I went through all the documents and the emails, Tommy, and this isn't my first rodeo with this group. I know that you have to have backup in case something like this happens. But if you follow the paper trail, we started discussing it internally on November 6th. I sent a term sheet that the administration was copied on by November 13th. By November 18th, we had a press conference on the doorstep of City Hall where the whole world knew about it. The administration participated in it. The administration prepared budget amendments that included the first payment of $10 million in them. That was all publicized per our council agenda the very same day. On November 21st, we had a council meeting where we passed the budget, and the mayor signed the budget on November 26th. And then for the next basically month and a half, everybody acted as if we were moving forward. So I don't know how you could make it any clearer in a flippant moment. The other day, I said, this is the worst secret I've ever kept. And maybe I shouldn't have been so pejorative about it. But the point is, for anybody to say they didn't know is simply untrue.
Truth is an absolute defense. You know that better than do I, Joe Geruso. Thank you. We'll talk to you again soon. We'll take a break. Come back. Talk to Dr. B, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. All kinds of stuff coming up here on WWL Saints Press Conference at 11:30. We get to meet Kellen Moore. And I saw Fletcher or Travers Mackle, I'm not quite sure which one it was, because, you know, they are identical twins, with an interesting tweet that Mickey Loomis tends to get the Saints head coach a quarterback they want, right? That he got Sean Payton, Drew Brees, Dennis Allen wanted Derek Carr, so we'll see what happens with Kellen Moore. And then before that, at 9:30, Mike Haas is going to have a big announcement about a big concert coming involving two stars in one big concert. That's at the Caesars Superdome, and we'll carry that for you. Meanwhile, it's Dr. B with People's Health talking about keeping healthy during the wintertime. A lot coming up. Stay with us, WWL. 8:13, I want to thank Shanika, my go-to pharmacist at CVS yesterday, for giving me my COVID, my flu shot a little bit late, and a tetanus shot. I don't know if it was cause and effect or not, but I spent the day sleeping in bed. Maybe it was because of the shot. Maybe I was just tired. Maybe I'm just lazy. Either way, I feel great today, and it is winter, which means colder weather, earlier sunsets, and cozier evenings. But winter also brings a rise in certain illnesses, including the flu and COVID-19. Dr. Brent Wallace joins us now, our friend, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, to talk about some simple ways to protect yourself and others during this time of year. How you doing, Dr. B?
Hey, Tommy. I'm doing good. How about you?
I'm okay. My arm's a little bit sore, but other than that, I feel great.
Good. I'm glad you got it done.
Is it normal to get a little sleepy or something after? Because, you know, dogs get sleepy after they get shots. I know it's different shots, but is that normal, or am I talking myself into spending all day in bed?
It could be a little of both, but no, you're absolutely correct. Very often when you get a vaccine, it'll actually cause a reaction because your body's creating all of those antibodies that are protective for you. And so, yeah, you can feel a little bit tired and need a little bit of rest, but usually after a day, everything's back to normal.
Feel great. And let me tell you, every now and then, there's nothing wrong with spending a day in bed, sleeping, catching up. Tell me about what kind of illnesses, Doc, are more common in winter.
Yeah, so really in the winter time, you know, the majority of what we see are respiratory illnesses. So that's anything that affects your lungs or your airways. And there's a lot of reasons for this, but in particular, we tend to spend a little bit more time indoors during this time of the year. So it's easy for germs to spread from person to person. And then, you know, we haven't had this lately, but it is a little cooler today, and that cold, dry air actually can weaken your immune system and actually your body's defenses against those respiratory illnesses, so it can make it a little bit harder to fight them off.
What are some examples of respiratory illnesses?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest ones we see, pneumonia, which can be very severe, bronchitis is very common. We are seeing a lot of RSV right now, or respiratory syncytial virus, and then really the common cold. Those are all respiratory illnesses. And like you were just saying, the two really big ones we're seeing right now are the flu and COVID-19. And the part that's a little difficult about these is they all have common symptoms. You know, people usually will have things like coughing or sneezing, maybe even a fever. And so it can make it real tricky to tell those different ones apart and figure out what you have going on.
Let's talk about the two themselves, COVID-19 and flu, the common winter illnesses. How do they spread?
Yeah, so both of those illnesses are caused by viruses that spread through what we call personal contact. And so what that means is when a person who's infected either coughs or sneezes or even talks, little tiny droplets can spray into the air, and those droplets then can be inhaled by someone who is close by, or they can often land directly in the mouth and nose of somebody who's close by. These viruses, too, can live, you know, for a period of time on certain surfaces as well. They can attach to railings or doorknobs, and it's less common, but you could actually become infected by, for example, you know, touching a surface or a doorknob that has the virus on it and then rubbing your face, because you're actually introducing the virus right into your body.
Yeah, I just got to say that years ago, even before COVID, I think it was you that told me about, you know, keeping your hands out of your face. And since I've done that, I don't think I've had a cold. It's amazing. It all comes from your hands, accurate, or most of it?
Yeah, absolutely it does. That's usually how we transmit things around.
Which brings us to how you can protect yourself from getting sick.
Exactly. I mean, and this is really critical, but good hygiene goes a really long way when you're trying to avoid all of these illnesses. Things like the flu and COVID-19, all of these things can be passed relatively easily. And so washing your hands is absolutely critical. And you've got to use soap and water when you do that. And then you want to scrub for at least 20 seconds. So a little trick you can do is, like, in your head, sing the happy birthday song. That's about 20 seconds. And as long as you do that, you're going to wash your hands enough. If you don't have access to soap and water, you can use those alcohol-based hand sanitizers, and most of them have 60% alcohol or more. That's what you need to actually kill the germs. And then something, you know, I tell people all the time, please, if you're going to cough or sneeze out in public, cover your mouth. You know, either use a tissue, or you can even do it into the inside of your elbow. And then after you do that, you really want to wash your hands right away, too, so you're not spreading those germs around. And then it can help as well to clean those high-touch surfaces, things like light switches and countertops and doorknobs, because you want to make sure you eliminate any opportunity that things are going to adhere there and then be passed around.
Let's talk about vaccines and how they work.
Yeah, definitely.
Wait, I'm jumping ahead of myself here, Doctor. I'm sorry. I have a lot of questions for you. And we were talking about washing your hands often. And when you're talking about singing happy birthday, that'd be like what, like 20 seconds or something?
Yeah, about 20 seconds. So it's just a little trick you can do to make sure you're not, you know, I see some people, they'll just kind of wet their hands and they're done. They're out the door. And you really do need to wash for a little bit longer to kill off all of those germs.
And what else can we do?
Yeah, I mean, another thing you can do during this time of year is, you know, especially if you're susceptible to a lot of these illnesses, if you've got other things going on like diabetes or heart disease, you want to try to stay away from really crowded indoor spaces. You know, you want to keep distance from other people because these are going around, and the closer you are to people in more confined spaces, you're more likely to pick something up. And, you know, people can still wear face masks. I actually see people occasionally do this, and face masks do actually prevent the spread of most respiratory illnesses. And then a really, really critical one, and people don't do this all the time, but if you feel sick, stay home. You know, don't go into work, don't go grocery shopping, because if you're actually sick, you're out there and you're actually spreading that illness around. You want to reach out to your doctor, talk to them about your symptoms, and ask maybe if you should be tested for a certain illness. We've got really quick and easy tests that can tell you what you have, and then you'll know how long you're going to be contagious and how long you need to be careful.
All right, let's take a break. We come back, we're going to talk about protecting yourself from the flu and COVID-19, which brings us to vaccines. We talked with Mike Sturin earlier about vaccinating animals when it comes to the bird flu and keeping the food supply safe. Unfortunately, science turned political. That's not good, but we'll address it with Dr. B when we come back, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health. I got vaccinated yesterday, feeling great today. 820 traffic now, WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Anxious to get back to Dr. Brent Wallace, Chief Medical Officer of People's Health, talking about staying healthy during this time of year. Doc, best way to protect yourself from the flu and COVID-19.
Yeah, well, you just did it yesterday. Getting vaccinated is the absolute best way to protect from these respiratory illnesses. And, you know, flu shots and COVID-19 vaccines are really proven to greatly reduce your chance of getting sick. And if you do contract one of the illnesses, it typically is much less severe than it would be had you not had the shot. And really, most adults, almost all adults, should have a yearly flu shot. And at least one dose of the updated COVID-19 vaccine. But you want to talk to your doctor about what is individual for you and what they think you need to get.
Tell me how vaccines work, please.
Yeah, I mean, the way you think about it, the vaccines are kind of like a trial run or a practice for your immune system. They're typically made from either inactivated pieces of a virus or just a protein that looks like the virus. And so when you're injected with it, it tricks your immune system into thinking you got the infection. So it kicks into high gear and starts producing all of those antibodies that are going to protect you when you do possibly get exposed to the actual illness. And it really protects you from all of these viruses over time.
For those that know, no explanation is needed. For those that don't, maybe no explanation will suffice. But there are a lot of myths about vaccines. Let's talk about the three big ones. And I would ask the audience, please just open your mind. Go ahead, Doc.
Yeah, and I hear this all the time, but, you know, vaccines are absolutely safe. You know, anyone who says they're not is not looking at 50 years of research that's gone on. Hundreds of millions of Americans have safely received things like the flu shot, you know, year after year, and the research continues to show that not only are they safe, but they're extremely effective as well. And COVID-19 in particular, you know, a lot of talk around that one, but it actually went through the most intensive safety analysis in the U.S.'s history. And there are ongoing monitoring policies that are in place. So anytime somebody does have a reaction to a vaccine, we as physicians actually are required to report that. And that is logged, and that actually creates even more research to see if there are any safety issues. So if you're hesitant about getting any of the vaccines, please talk to your doctor. Don't Google it.
And I mentioned sleeping all day yesterday, but I get up at 3, so that could be part of the reason. But why do people sometimes feel sick or tired after having a vaccine?
Yeah, it's very common, like we were saying, to have those side effects after a vaccine. You know, soreness in the arm is probably the most common one. But even something like a low-grade fever can happen, and that's good. It means the vaccine's working. It means your body is ramping up, and it's creating those antibodies so that it can protect you from the illness if it does come along.
Myth number two, you don't need to be revaccinated every year.
Yeah, and really for a lot of vaccines, in particular flu and COVID, your immunity can lessen over time. It's just a normal part of the process. And so getting another shot every year boosts you. It gives you a little extra boost of protection so you can stay healthy. The other thing a lot of people don't realize is that the viruses change from year to year. And so we reformulate the flu and the COVID vaccine annually based on what we're seeing going on in the community and the changes happening in the virus. So you want to get boosted so you've got protection against whatever is floating around that year.
Sometimes people think that healthy people don't need to be vaccinated.
Yeah, and that's another problem. Healthy people absolutely do need to be vaccinated because they can get the illness too. And in fact, actually this year we've had over 300,000 hospitalizations from the flu alone. And people get admitted to the hospital, they can develop other complications, and it can be really bad even if you don't have those high-risk complications. And then the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, be a good neighbor. Keep in mind that if you get vaccinated, you're less likely to get the disease, and then you're less likely to spread it. So you're going to protect all of your loved ones around you who might be more vulnerable because of diseases like diabetes and heart disease.
Doc, how long did it take you to get through medical school?
It feels like 20 years.
No, but really, how long?
It was, with all my training and everything, it was about 10 years.
10 years, okay. And how long have you been practicing medicine?
Almost 25.
25. So I guess I couldn't accomplish the same thing by going to Google and finding something in 30 seconds?
I hope not. No, it does take a lot of education and a lot of experience to understand all of this stuff.
I think I made my point. Thank you, Doc. Dr. B,
thanks,
Chief
Tony.
Medical Officer of People's Health. You can always find out more about People's Health by going to peopleshealth.com. You can call them at 1-800-978-9765. You can always visit the People's Health Medicare Center, 3017 Vets, right next to Party City. We'll take a break, come back. We're going to talk to Chef Jean-Luc Albon. We'll remember Tom Fitzmaurice briefly, and then we'll talk about Louisiana's economy and the mental health crisis. A lot coming up. Stay with us. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Here we go, 840, 20 till 9. You hear about Alex Bregman's big contract, and a lot of people automatically text in and say, oh, I'm going to give my kid a baseball bat and a glove. And, of course, you would also have to give him the extraordinary level of ability and hand-eye coordination and those kind of things that player has. We'll take a break. We come back. We're going to talk to Anita Raj, Executive Director of the Newcomb Institute at Tulane University, researcher with the Celia Scott Weatherhead School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine, about Louisiana's economy and the state's mental health crisis and the effect that it has on the economy. Big day here at WWL at 9:30. We'll go live to the Caesars Superdome, where Mike Haas has an announcement about a big concert that's coming involving two stars in one concert. So we got that for you at 9:30. Then at 11:30, the introductory press conference with new head coach and Super Bowl champion Kellen Moore, Mickey Loomis, Gail Benson, and more. But before that, at 10:30, Archie Manning's going to be on with Newell Norman and Lou Fregoso, CEO of Children's Hospital, to talk about Manning Family Children's. A lot coming up, man. We got it all for you right here on the Big 870, WWL, AM, FM, and .com. 848 1210-9, joined by Anita Raj, Executive Director of the Newcomb Institute at Tulane University, researcher with the Celia Scott Weatherhead School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine, to talk about improving Louisiana's economy and tackling the state's mental health crisis. Good morning, Doc. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me, Tommy.
Thanks.
I'm good.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Tell me. Go ahead.
You just said, I'm good, considering the topic. It's a good time to speak about how you're feeling.
Yeah, talk about that, if you would, please, and also the effect on the economy.
Yeah, so we did a study in 2023. You were kind enough to invite us in, to speak about that at that time. And the study was focused on violence and various health aspects, but also just sort of the economic circumstances of people in Louisiana. And this is a statewide sample to really be able to give a robust statistic on what is happening for Louisiana adults. With some of the issues that are getting, that coming to light with mental health, we decided to look carefully at the mental health questions and substance abuse questions from that survey. And what we find is about one in three Louisianans are engaging in binge alcohol use just in the past 30 days. Mm. About one in eight, 13%, have engaged in illicit drug use in the past 30 days. And about almost one in 10, one in 11 Louisianans have severe depression, anxiety, and have thought about suicide in the past year.
Are there root factors, root causes behind that? Commonalities, Doc?
Yeah, so some of the things we know about mental health and substance use is that absolutely one of the big factors is the younger you are, the more likely you are to see these issues. So it's very much disproportionately affecting our young population. Certainly environments where there is economic stress, a lack of economic opportunity, economic job loss, we know that those things affect these issues as well, and that's going to be particularly true for men.
One thing I did want to make sure that we made clear, when it comes to fentanyl, and we hear about the problems with fentanyl, at no point has the legitimate drug supply been compromised. Those are all illegal medications that people buy from here or there. Accurate?
That is accurate. Fentanyl is a fairly small proportion, though, of our illicit drug use. But nonetheless, it's a key issue with our overdoses in the state. And so there's some concern where, yes, we're losing to deaths and overdose, but we're also losing, there's some concern that that's a group that's at greater risk for suicide as well.
And it skews primarily male, does it not?
It does skew primarily male. And
let me take a break, Doc, and we'll pick it up there when we come back. Why? What are some of the causes why it skews male? We're talking about high suicide rates, and how do you fix it? Very respected Anita Raj, our guest, executive director of the Newcomb Institute at Tulane University, researcher with the Celia Scott Weatherhead School of Public Health and Tropical Medicine, 852. Traffic now, WWL. 8:56, quickly back to Dr. Anita Raj, a developmental psychologist with Tulane that studied mental health in Louisiana, mental health and suicidality. One in nine Louisiana adults have contemplated suicide. It skews heavily male. And Doc, I got to ask, is it about education? Is it about employment? Is it about men being told to just suck it up and bottle up your feelings? Tell me about that.
I absolutely think you've hit on major issues that are contributing to this, and certainly economic opportunity, the ability for men to be able to feel like they are contributors to their household, or it's really compromised when you don't have the job. We are definitely seeing a differential in advancement in education. We lose more boys in our school system. So these are all things we really need to worry about. But I also want to just highlight that it goes down to about one in six when you start to look at the 18 to 29-year-olds for both men and women. About one in six have thought about suicide in the past year. And then when you go to 30 to 44-year-olds, that women, the decline is substantial. We see much less suicidality for women, but it stays at one in six for men. And so, you know, one thing we want to make sure people know is 988 is the helpline for people who are in need. If you or someone else you know needs help, 988 is a number you can call at no cost. But yeah, we're really concerned about men and young people and men in Louisiana.
Does that have anything to do with maybe women becoming mothers at that age? I don't mean to draw conclusions that aren't there, and men not having gone as far up the ladder of success as they would have hoped to?
It could be. I mean, I can't give you an absolute answer from these data, but one of the things I think you bring up is a really important one. If the highest prevalence of suicidality or considering suicide is in that 18 to 29 age group for women, that's really disconcerting because that's often when women are having their first child. And we know we have a maternal mortality rate. We know we have a high morbidity, a maternal morbidity rate. And maternal depression is absolutely part of that picture.
Is postpartum depression a big undertreated issue when it comes to mental health?
I have to say, you very much are knowledgeable about this topic without me even being prepared to answer your question.
Because I know people, Doc.
Right.
That's why I know people. That's all. But go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. Postpartum depression is a big part of this. I think it's also just, generally people need to feel a sense of hope and opportunity for stability and prosperity. And we are obviously living in some difficult times. We still see the effects of COVID. We know COVID had a huge impact on mental health. And obviously, economic stressors continue to be the case. You want to make sure that you can take care of your children when you're pregnant. And that can be hard in a climate where you may not see the opportunity or you may be concerned about health issues.
988, that's the number in case you're thinking of harming yourself. Dr. Raj, never enough time, but I hope you come back because this is very important. Thank you for your work.
Thank you. So grateful for the time. Thanks, Tommy.
Thank you. Dr. Anita Raj with Tulane. We'll take a break, come back, talk about EVs and Donald Trump. All right, 9:09. It's going to be an active hour here at WWL and a somewhat fluid hour, so I would ask you to bear with us. We're waiting on Mike Haas to make a big announcement at the Superdome, at the Caesars Superdome. The Mercedes-Benz End Zone Club, I get it, at the Caesars Superdome. He's going to make a big announcement about a concert featuring two big stars in one concert. So we'll go to Mike Haas when he does that at 9:30-ish. And we may have to interrupt our guests. We're going to talk about EVs, and we'll talk with Mandy Landry about education savings accounts and more. Then at 11:30, we got the Saints press conference as they introduced Kellen Moore. But before that, Newell at 10 o'clock is going to have Lou Fregoso and Archie Manning to talk about Manning Children's Hospital. Saints press conference is at 11:30. Yeah, so Newell's got some time before that, but we'll carry it for you. In case you've not heard, we all know Shaq is going to be the Grand Marshal or whatever it is, the head of Bacchus. He will be Bacchus. And I can't believe that I came up with Shaqus. I would think somebody else would have come up with that. But Livy Dunn is going to be the Grand Marshal of Endymion. And you think immediately that means two vastly different size floats. Let's talk about EVs now with our EV go guy, Stephen Melnick, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. He's done research in a strategic supply chain, cybersecurity performance measurements, and supply chain design. And we're talking about funding for charging stations specifically today. Good morning, Doctor. How are you?
Not bad. Enjoying the snow here.
Well, good for you. We had it a little bit, and we had enough of it, so you can have it. Let's talk about...
Yeah, go on.
No, well, what did you want to say?
I just want to say we had 6 to 8 inches, so we're enjoying it.
That's what we had, and we enjoyed it for about a day, and then not so much. Let's talk about the Trump administration. I'll set the stage, and then you can take off. Trump administration pausing federal funding for charging stations. Elon Musk is at the right hand of the president. He sells electric vehicles, but does he have his own separate proprietary charging stations? What about the other EVs? I've opened it up, Professor. Jump in where you feel comfortable.
Okay, let's go on and just make sure we understand the stage. I think it was in 2021, Biden, in a bipartisan vote, we provided funding, which was approved by Congress, to what's known as the NEVI Act, the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Act. What that did is it provided money to the states to fund the charging network. Now, what happened is we've now got Trump coming in, and what happened recently last week, Trump comes in and he basically tells the states to stop spending money for an EV infrastructure, charging infrastructure. The problem we have is twofold. Certain states, such as Rhode Island, have done that. Other states, this money has been approved. It has been allocated. It is there. So essentially, if you're going to stop spending that approved money, Trump has got to get approval of the states. And we need to get an infrastructure for EVs, because if we want to see EVs become more dominant, one of the things that's going to prevent it from being dominant is lack of high-speed, dependable charging stations. And I'm going to point those two things up. You've got to have availability, you've got to have high speed, and you've got to have dependability. One of the things we found in one of the things people talk about when they're dealing with EVs is availability is spotty, especially if you get outside the big cities. Number two, many of them are not necessarily high speed, which means you're going to sit there for a long time. Great way of wasting time. And number three, many of them aren't dependable. There are numerous examples on YouTube of people coming up to a charging station, and it's not there. One person did a video where he went off for a 10-day trip. He parked his car in Phoenix at an EV station in the airport, and it wasn't available. It was not working. He couldn't find any of them to work. So the purpose of the bill was to provide those three elements. Now, Trump has paused funding in billions for these national rollouts. However, the funding that has been allocated, approved, committed, the states can go ahead and spend on them. So this is setting up a battle, so to speak, between Trump, the states, and essentially Congress, where Congress, in order for these things to be revoked, you've got to get Congress involved. If we want to see EVs, we're going to have to see that charging structure. That then leads up to an interesting question. What's the role of Elon Musk? Elon Musk has himself one of the largest charging stations that he's rolling out. Of all the charging stations around, it's the highest power. So on one hand, I'm wondering what game he's playing. On the other hand, if I was Elon Musk, I'm next to the president. I can influence him. So I'm trying to figure out Elon Musk's game there. And on top of that, one of the other things that if I was Elon Musk, I'd really be concerned about is the demand for my cars has really, not simply in the United States, but across the world, has fallen off a cliff. For example, the Netherlands, demand year over year has fallen by 49%. France, the demand is 63% off. The Germany, the demand is, I think it's 59% off. So when I'm looking at Musk and what he's facing, somebody did a calculation which says Musk is not making money on his EVs. He's making money on cryptocurrency, and he's making money on selling carbon credits, where his product is accumulating carbon credits because it's not negatively impacting the environment, and he's using that to sell to other companies, which are negatively impacting the economy. If you take that out, his EV business is not doing well.
Let me go to his EV business and charging stations. Can any electric vehicle use a Tesla charging station, and can any Tesla use any EV charging station?
I can't tell you the second part, but the first part I can comment on. Remember, when you charge, your plug goes into his plug, and there's a communication that goes back and forth. So for you to use his charging station, your system has to be approved, which is one reason why recently companies like Mercedes-Benz, like BMW, and others have agreed to make the Tesla charging system the standard. It's called the North American Charging Standard. They've agreed, and that means that they have agreed to work with Tesla on that. So on one hand, Tesla has his own charging stations. I would say that, given that I don't have an EV, I would And given that Tesla's been around, I'd say that probably a Tesla could use a non-Tesla station, but what you give up is speed. You're going to be going, you're going to be charging not as fast. And so you've got that going on right now. So Tesla's developed his own station. But on the other hand, what's really interesting is not only Tesla standard, but if the Chinese ever get into the United States, they're going to be coming in on, with the ability to charge at a far faster rate. So that creates another dimension of problems, which is, can the infrastructure keep pace with the new demands? Because some of these Chinese cars can charge within 10 minutes.
So
you've got number, go on.
Well, the question I have is, long game here, could Elon Musk be trying to influence the president to stop construction on these stations so that his charging stations are the only game in town as other EV manufacturers agree to comply to the Tesla standards? Could that be a long game here or not?
I think it could be. I'm not privy to what's in Elon Musk's mind, but that wouldn't surprise me, because right now Tesla is actively funding his charging system. So that's an investment he's making. And if I was Tesla, I would prefer everyone to move to my standard, because number one, it makes sure that their cars are using my system. And number two, when they charge, I'm getting money not only from selling energy, but also from the fact that I'm charging them a Mercedes, a Stellantis, GM. They're being charged to access my network. So those two things would make it very attractive for me. Maybe, I don't know, but that wouldn't surprise me, especially since he's not having much luck. There are concerns about his car sales. Let's put it that way.
And so when it comes to the Tesla charging stations themselves, that was my next question, having only ridden in a EV one time. And I got to tell you, it was in Washington. It was a Luminaire. Is that the name of it? Luminaire?
Okay, I don't know the company, but go on.
But it was a nice ride. It was a very heavy, smooth ride, but if you can't power it, it's not going to do you any good, right? So when it comes to charging a Tesla, people pay for that, like gasoline? And when it comes to these public charging stations, I presume they would pay whom? The municipality? Because nothing's free, right?
Well, it's not free, because when you connect it, what it's going to do, in the case of a Tesla, when you connect the power, the charger up to it, you've got an account with Tesla. So it's monitoring how much electricity it's putting in, and it's charging you for it. Electricity, it's not a free good, so you have to be charged for it. So you're paying for it just the same way as if you pay for gas. The issue is, so there's a number of issues present there, but currently, what you pointed out is, number one, EV cars are attractive because, number one, they're quiet. Number two, they're fast. If you go in an EV car and you put the accelerator down, they move.
And they're so heavy, it's an incredibly smooth ride, Professor.
Oh, it is. It is an incredibly smooth ride. So you've got a car that's quiet, incredibly smooth, and fast. The problem that you've got is charging it and how long it takes to charge and finding a dependable charging station. So, and by the way, that even gets worse in winter. EV usage, EV battery power, you can expect, typically when people talk about EV ranges, it's best case. If you're up here in Michigan and we're getting near to zero, you can expect your battery range to drop anywhere from 30 to 40%. So that means you've got to charge much more frequently. So guess what? You're worried about those issues.
So for people that have, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back 9:22, talking to our go-to guy when it comes to EVs and the president pausing funding on building infrastructure to support EVs, and could the long game be Elon Musk in the president's ear saying, look, let's stop spending money on this And then he has a proprietary Tesla charging stations that other companies, manufacturers are adhering to. And then he becomes the only game in town. Of course, what does that mean in terms of electric vehicles? Because the president, I don't think, is a big fan of electric vehicles. And to be fair, on the other side of that, he says he wants you to be able to buy ICE, internal combustion engine cars, into the foreseeable future. So one could short circuit the other. I don't know. It's confusing. Don't forget, a big announcement coming up at 10:30. We'll go live to Mike Haas at the Dome for that when it happens. Right now, we'll take a break on WWL. 9:27, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Steve Belnick, our friend. He's our EV go-to guy. He studied this, professor of supply chain management at Michigan State. And I'm getting some text here, professor. I don't know what's true, what's not, because like I told you, I only ridden a car in an EV one time. It was a Luminaire or something like that. It was nice, but
I know about the Luminaires. They're an interesting car.
It was beautiful. Beautiful to look at, beautiful to ride in, very expensive. And again, if you can't power it, well, you know, you just got a wheelbarrow. Somebody texted in and said, so I'm a Tesla owner. I do pay when I use a Tesla charger, but it is minimal in comparison to the price of gas. There are a bunch of public chargers in Orleans Parish that are free, provided by Entergy. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but as a guy that does business with the same company that is a public-related, a public utility that's guaranteed a rate of return, I don't want to pay for this guy's electricity to power his car. So go ahead.
I'm going to. You've also hit on something else that companies, that states are now coming to grips with. How do you maintain the roads in a state? What's the major source of funding? Well, it's the when you go up to a gas station and you pull off the hose and you put into your gas tank, how much of that gas price is not simply the gas, but it's tax?
Mm-hmm.
Now you have a problem. EVs are tapping into electricity, the same electricity that people use to power their homes, the same electricity that the poor use. How do you then if okay? A little comment. You made a statement. I just want to, in order to make this statement make sense, you made a statement about Trump and Elon Musk, mm-hmm. Trump being against EVs. Elon Musk, on a recent investor call, made the statement that EVs are inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
His comment is that, you know, Trump may think he can delay them, but they're inevitable, and he understands the
importance. Trump did say that, and they are at odds when it comes to that, right?
He does, okay. But the point of the matter is he's saying you can say that you're against it, but if everyone's moving to an EV, guess what? It's like being like King Canute putting his throne into the English Channel and trying to command the waves to stop. Waves don't really listen to people like that. So what happens is he's bringing it up. So you've got an issue, and the issue that you've got is as acceptance of EVs increases, we're going to have a demand for charging stations. Because EVs are heavier because of their battery packs, and we can expect that weight to decrease as new technology enters, but in the short term, we're going to have increased weight on the roads. This is going to put greater stress on roads. We're going to start to see problems as roads break down, and this is a concern to people in areas like Minnesota, Michigan, Illinois. Why? Because you put weight on roads, it puts fissures. When water gets in there, freezes, expands, causes potholes. And we know about potholes. So you're going to have an issue, which is, okay, as we move from ICE to EVs, states are going to have a problem. How do I replace the tax, the revenue I got from fuel taxes in order to maintain my roads? So what we're starting to see in Michigan, I'm not exactly sure of the cost, but there's been an increase in the registration cost. So if I have an ICE car, I pay a lower registration than I do if I have an EV. And we're going to start to see that go up because somehow you're going to have to recover revenues. Now, the problem with that is that if I see EVs as being inevitable, I want to drive down the price of EVs. And all of this stuff is driving up the price.
Professor, let me jump in for 1 second. I might have to interrupt you at some point because we're awaiting a big announcement from the Caesars Superdome. I'll let you know if we do. But until then, let me get to this. Entergy New Orleans has 30 free public electric vehicle EV stations at 25 locations throughout New Orleans. It's a partnership with Entergy New Orleans and the City of New Orleans, and the goal is to provide equitable access to EV charging stations. Now, nothing is free, right? That's the one thing I've learned in my life. Somebody's paying for this electricity, whether it's Entergy, and they're guaranteed a rate of return. So I would presume that's passed on at some point to the other electric user, energy users, or the city's paying for it. And if they are, and it's to be equitable, I don't know if that means in terms of EVs or income, but then is that really different than subsidizing gasoline for people that have ICE engines?
That's a good question. And I think, you know, you've hit on the point. Companies are introducing, if utility companies are offering free charging, and that is to encourage the adoption of EVs. What we have going on here is, it's like, you know, I can give you the first taste free once you've committed to it. At some point, I'm going to have to start charging you an equitable rate. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to have to make sure that I charge you in such a way that it reflects some of the demands, so that I can recover the maintenance for my infrastructure. I can recover the maintenance for the roads. That's not a free good. Those are actual expenses. So in the short term, they're encouraging people with free EV, with free electricity, but that's not a long-term strategy. You need resources to create electricity. You need resources to create infrastructure. In the long term, we're going to start to see that as soon as we get a critical mass, enough people who've adopted EVs, you're going to have to charge them. And guess what? It's like if you go and look at the cable companies mm-hmm. offer you a great rate initially. You sign up, and what happens? Next year comes around, and there's a price increase. This is the same effect.
Professor, let me jump in for a second with Elon Musk, and if he were to develop proprietary charging stations where every manufacturer were to go with the Tesla standard, are we ready? Hi, yeah. Professor. Let me take a break. Here we go to the podium. We go Caesars Superdome big concert announcement.
What was an amazing event last Sunday, which was just a few days ago, and really the loadout, but continue the momentum for this building and this city. Over the last 49 years, almost 50 years, in August, the Superdome has become one of the most iconic venues in the country, if not the world, not only for football, and I think there's some football news later today as well, but for important social, cultural, and musical events as well. It is the combination of our city, our people, our music, that we continue to be able to welcome iconic artists, plural, to Caesars Superdome year after year. At this time, I would like to introduce Evan Holmes, General Manager of Caesars Superdome and ASM Legends, to announce the next artists to bring fans from all over to New Orleans to perform in the Superdome.
Thank you, Mike, and welcome back, everyone. Those of you that were here over the weekend, welcome back. Those of you that weren't here, I'm sure you saw how great an experience we had over the weekend and highlight this building, the city, and the state across the world. So I'm not one for kind of letting it linger, so want to get right to the point of gathering everybody here today. So we are excited to announce, along with our partners at Live Nation, who you hear from here in a second, that for the first time in 21 years at the Superdome, for the first time in 8 years at the Smoothie King Center, we're excited to welcome back Billy Joel, along with Stevie Nicks, to the Superdome on Saturday, October 18th. Billy Joel, as you know, is one of the most respected artists in modern musical history. He is, I'll make sure to get this right here, he is the sixth best-selling artist and the fourth best-selling solo artist, with more than 160 million records sold worldwide. With Billy Joel, along with Stevie Nicks, we believe we have one of the most attractive performing artists that you could hope for in a city that we know has wrapped their arms around both artists individually, and to have them together, we're looking forward to a really exciting Saturday night. With that said, I think there's a video to where we'll launch this announcement, and then I'll turn it over to Grant Lyman from Live Nation to talk more about the details. So with that, we'll play a video.
The video they're showing now is a promotional video. This looks like this will be a commercial that will be running on local TV stations as well as online, showing footage of Billy Joel and Stevie Nicks in concert over the last couple of years. This has been an ongoing tour, though with limited dates over the course of the last couple of years. And now back to Evan Holmes.
With that, Grant Lyman.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Hey, good morning, everybody. My name is Grant Lyman, and I'm the Southeast Region President for Live Nation. We're all thrilled to be standing here today in this legendary venue to announce Billy Joel with Stevie Nicks live from Caesars Superdome on October 18. This venue has hosted its share of magical moments throughout history, from Muhammad Ali beating Leon Spinks for his final professional win, to Michael Jordan helping deliver an NCAA championship for North Carolina, to hosting a record 8 Super Bowls as recently as a few days ago. It's our honor to be a part of continuing that legacy of creating magical moments in the city by welcoming Billy Joel back to New Orleans alongside Stevie Nicks for what will be one of only 5 concerts together in 2025. Billy Joel also has a history of creating magical moments. He's won 6 Grammy Awards, including the prestigious Grammy Legend Award. He's been inducted to the Songwriters Hall of Fame, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and he's received a Tony Award for Moving Out, a Broadway musical based on his music. Stevie Nicks is also one of rock and roll's most successful and groundbreaking artists. She's a multi-platinum and Grammy Award winning solo artist and a member of Fleetwood Mac. She's the first woman to have been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice and has collectively sold more than 220 million albums. Now, New Orleans needs no introduction when it comes to its live music, history, and heritage. We're honored every time we get to be a part of it through hosting our shows at the House of Blues, Fillmore, Smoothie King Center, and other storied venues throughout town. It's a city that shows up to support live music and one that people eagerly travel to for their chance to see their favorite artists. New Orleans knows how to throw a party, and we're excited to keep the party going at the Caesars Superdome on October 18. I'd now like to welcome Alice Glenn, the Executive Vice President for New Orleans & Company.
Thank you. Thanks so much, everyone. We at New Orleans & Company could not be more excited to be partnering with our fantastic friends at ASM, the Caesars Superdome, Live Nation, for this huge event. We work every day to inspire, promote, and encourage travel to our city for the benefit of our community, whether we're doing that by hosting our record-tying 11th Super Bowl, welcoming 4,000 convention-goers into the hotel as the winning team is moving out earlier this week, or now being here to announce an iconic, world-renowned performance happening later this year. Music is really such a critical and essential foundational part of our culture, and so we work day in and day out, year-round, to make sure that we're promoting our local artists, absolutely, but welcoming international icons into an iconic venue like the Caesars Superdome is where magic really happens. So we have proven again and again that we can host milestone championship events, iconic events like this one, safely, joyfully. And so we look forward to working over the next few weeks and months to make sure that all of the fans, visitors, and residents who I know are so excited for this event to come to enjoy. Thanks, everyone.
Members of Live Nation, Evan, anybody that you need will be available afterward for one-on-one interviews, and we can have a B-roll package if you need that as well. And my thanks to Karen. I won't even try her last name for benefit of that, but we thank you all. And it is about momentum, right? We just finished the Super Bowl. The last time we hosted a Super Bowl was 2013, and New Orleans kept the momentum going in 2013 with Jazz Fest. On the Acura stage at Jazz Fest in 2013, Billy Joel. The next week on the Acura stage in 2013, Stevie Nicks. We kept the momentum going. But now, October 18th, same building, same stage, one performance. That's going to be exciting. My thanks to Evan, Alice, and Grant for their participation. We appreciate you coming to Caesars Superdome this morning on the heels of the Super Bowl, and we hope you are as excited about Billy Joel and Stevie Nicks, one night, one stage, as we are. And finally, again, thank Karen, as she will sing us a song to take us out. Thanks, everyone.
All right, 9:41, 19 till 10. That's from the Superdome about Billy Joel and Stevie Nicks coming in concert Saturday, October 18th. I did not hear anything about... Oh, we want to hear the song? Good, play the song. No, that we're not going to do that. 9:42, 18 till 10. We're going to take a break. We'll find out when tickets go on sale and be back here on WWL. Traffic, WWL. Let me tell you about APS. Mardi Gras here. Big celebrations, a lot of fun, a lot of excitement, a lot of big crowds, a lot of stuff coming to the city. But if you've ever felt uneasy in a crowd, APS wants you to know about the safety button from Alarm Protection Services, your personal safety companion 24/7, no matter where you are. With just one tap, you're going to be connected to a trained emergency responder who can dispatch help to your exact location. And for a limited time, you can get your first month free. That means peace of mind throughout the entire Mardi Gras season. No more worried about getting lost in the crowd or walking to your car alone or maybe your grown kids or significant other. Take control of your safety today. Sign up now at securitybyaps.com for the safety button. Securitybyaps.com or call them at 504-455-5277. The safety button. Protection at your fingertips from Alarm Protection Services. All right, 9:57, been a busy morning. Billy Joel, Stevie Nicks could be in concert at the Superdome Saturday, October 18th. Pre-sale is next Monday after this weekend. They go on sale next Friday. You can go to Ticketmaster.com. Not a lot of information to be had online yet, but it's coming. Newell, I know you love music. I presume you've seen Billy Joel and Stevie Nicks both in concert before?
I have and would love to go to this concert, quite frankly.
I know you love music.
This may be both of their last tour, right?
Yep, and you know, there's something to be said. Even back in the days of FM radio with me, with hosting the oldies acts where they didn't have what they once had, but there's something to be said for seeing an iconic American artist do that song live. I don't care if it's Paul McCartney, I don't care who it is, right?
No, absolutely.
So,
no doubt about it.
You got some information coming up on your show today. You got a pretty big 3 hours planned.
We're going to visit with Rafael Goyeneche in the back half of the 12 o'clock hour. We've got a lot to talk about there. We'll talk about the most recent decision on NOPD promotions as one topic. And then we'll cover the live press conference where the Saints named the new head coach, Kellen Moore. So we'll go live out there with Bobby Hebert and others to cover that event. And we start out this morning in the back half of the 10 o'clock hour. We're going to visit with Archie Manning, legendary Saints quarterback, my favorite quarterback of all quarterbacks for the Saints, and Lou Fregosa, CEO of Children's Hospital, about the legacy gift that they're leaving for the Children's Hospital of LCMC.
So you got a full 3 hours planned. We saw talked to Joe Geruso a little bit this morning, listening to, you know, and it was hard for me to take. I'm not trying to attack the mayor here, but you know, and I even quoted Shakespeare saying the world's a stage, and I saw her taking the bows at the Superdome and everything else. But when it comes to day-to-day management of city government, this foolishness with the Orleans Parish School Board and the settlement and now claiming that they didn't know what was going on, some of this stuff defies belief.
Well, the worst part about it is that they've been telling us that they don't have a money problem. Now, all of a sudden, they have a money problem. That was the same situation that existed with the school board where they had a $30 million hiccup. They didn't realize that there was $30 million there that they didn't have, which has actually brought them to the table to try and settle this litigation.
Now, I got to tell you, going before a slew of lawyers yesterday and trying to claim plausible deniability on this. I thought that was pretty silly, too. Knowles next. If you ever dreamt of riding in a carnival parade, WWL's got your tickets to ride with the crew of Argus on Mardi Gras Day. Just go to WWL.com/contest. Register to win a ride of a lifetime. It's from Honda of Covington. Knowles next. Got a jam-packed 3 hours.